Hi, I'm Arthur Gurevich. I'm with the W.R. Berkley Group. And this is the underwriting UND 1, Marrying Underwriter Intuition and Predictive Modeling, a Workers' Compensation Perspective. The presentation today will be by Gaetan Veyu and Matt Fraser, both of the Avalon Technology. Gaetan is a fellow. He's the Senior Director of Predictive Analytics, a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society. He's been building predictive models for over 8 years. Matt Fraser is client lead at Avalon with 15 years in workers' comp, product management, underwriting, and business development. They're going to tag team, so I don't even have to get up and do anything. They're on autopilot from now on. It's a kind of a Avalon operation. It runs on its own.
That's right.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm not quite sure it's the best time to be presenting right after lunch and everything. So my name is Gaetan Veyu. This is Matt Fraser over here. And we're actually going to start this presentation with a little vignette. I thought maybe that might help set the stage for the meat of our presentation, which is you've got predictive modelers, you've got their clients, their business partners, their underwriters. And we're both really a smart set of professionals, but we definitely come to the table with different perspectives. And if you don't recognize that in the very beginning and start to collaborate and work together right from the start, things may go wrong. Did you want to add anything to that?
No, it's fine.
Okay. So Matt and I are going to go back and forth during this presentation. We're not... So if we fumble a couple of times, forgive us. But anyway, so our little vignette. Predictive modeler has gone away. He's done a lot of analysis for the underwriter of this company. And today, the two get together to talk about the model that I, the predictive modeler, has built for Joe Underwriter. I'm not Joe Plummer, Joe Underwriter. And here we have Joe Underwriter. Okay. So... Mr. Underwriter, I've taken all the information that we talked about, I've taken the data that you sent me, and I've done an incredible amount of analysis, and I'm really proud of the model that I built. In fact, as you'll see in a minute, the model that I've developed has an incredible amount of lift, more so than I ever anticipated from the beginning. So just to set the stage, I thought I would let you see what the factors are in my model. Now, editorial aside, this is a workers' compensation model I've built, okay? So as you can see, that one of the factors that I've included in this model is an attorney count by zip code, right? Another one, which was a little bit of a surprise to me but proved to be very predictive, was hail size by county.
That's interesting, and I would just interject real quick because I'm interested how you got the county numbers.
The county numbers came off of the zip code that we were given.
Okay, we've got about four or five different zip codes in our data. Which one did you use? We've got a primary insurer, we've got... second primary insurer, we've got an agency zip, and then we've also actually got a zip code that we use for a totally different purpose than identifying where the risk is located.
You know what? I'm going to have to get back to you on that. I don't really remember which zip code it was. I'm thinking primary insured, but I'm not sure. So,
okay.
Well, can we follow up on that?
So I'm not sure whether it's going to be accurate or not.
Okay, but I based it on the notes that we had at our original meeting. All right, well, okay, let's set that aside.
Okay.
Additionally, we looked at late reporting where claims were reported greater than 30 days after the claim event. We looked at the frequency of claims in the prior policy period, not the current period, but the period 1 year back.
You didn't look at the current, or you did look at the current? And you
we found that the current didn't seem to show any lift, so we kept it out of the model.
So I'm talking to an agent. I'm going to need that information one turn back.
Yes, that's correct. Right.
Okay, that might be a little difficult to get. Okay.
Oh, that might be a problem. Okay. In addition to that, I came up with this really fabulous factor that I'm calling factor one. It's based on a principal components analysis of two historical loss type variables. One is the up to 3 year term loss ratio, and then the up to 3 year term pure premium.
What's that?
Well, you know what? I'll tell you what. I've got a graph later that will help me explain that to you.
Okay.
In addition, I included something that is the term sequence that was attached to the data file on each record, observation, and...
Okay. I'm not sure
talk about that at the original meeting, did we? I guess we're going to have to revisit that one.
Okay.
We also binned manual premium into premium size ranges, because when we looked at that, that was tremendous then, right? And finally, this last one.
Bin manual premium, you're saying larger?
All the larger houses
are
wanted
different
in.
Than smaller premiums?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm not sure about that. Okay, go ahead.
What is it with this underwriter? Okay. Well, the last one. Before I added this last factor, I found that class code seemed to be rather predictive. But I started noodling around with it. I started doing some transformations to the class code. And after several iterations, I came up with this, what I think is a really cool transformation. So I took the class code. I divided it by 176. 175 didn't work. 200 didn't work. And then I added to this little, we could call it a ballast factor of 11,237. Took all of that and logged it. And when we did that, the final, the lift for that particular predictive variable was out of this world.
Okay, I have absolutely no idea what you said. but I can tell you right now, if class code is predictive, then that thing right there, I have absolutely no idea what that's going to do.
Oh, let me see. Okay, hang on. Well, it's quasi-continuous, right? It's numeric. You know, 8117, for example, is an example. 5236. I forget what those mean. Okay. Well, let's just move on and take a quick look at the lift that I've gotten from my model. Look at this. Now, we're looking at the pure premium segmented into deciles, right? So you have your worst risks. Or I should call them risks. The risks with your highest indicated pure premium in this first decile over here, and those with your lowest indicated pure premium.
The target's pure premium.
Yes. Now we looked at
the underwriting model, though, when my underwriters are actually underwriting risks, they're not. They don't really care what the pure premium is.
Oh, could we convert that to loss ratio?
Sure. Okay.
Okay.
Well,
look at this.
We've got
build data, which is in the solid lines, and we've got test data that we held out to test our model results after the fact to see if indeed our models were robust. And we have actual data. The build is the red, the blue is the test, the dark line is the actual results, and the dotted line is the predictions. And
I tell you,
all those lines are just hugging each other, showing you that I have a very well-fitting model.
Yeah, you know, I was actually really concerned about that in annual review, because I figured all large premiums into one bin and all the small premiums into the other. So that seems to not be the case. It's very interesting.
Okay. Well, let's move on. Let's look at some of the individual factors that we've included in here. So we talked about the number of attorneys per county. Here's a look at how that fit our data. You can see the distribution of the histogram bars, right? Let's just move on.
Looks pretty consistent.
Yeah. Okay. Here's a graph of how hail size by county.
Help me out here, because I have absolutely no idea what in the heck hail size has to do with work
on. Neither do I, but it fits so well.
You gotta be kidding me.
Right now we're trying to let the data help us make decisions, okay? Is that all right?
Oh, sure. And then when I'm talking to an agent and saying, hey, you know what, you have a moral risk here, and they say, well, what do you mean? I'm going to say, hey, you know what, the hail size might be.
Okay, well, I guess that maybe what I'm getting out of this meeting is that we need to revisit some of this. Let's just go look at a couple more. Here's the here's a chart of frequency one turn back. And you can see they're getting tremendous lift there. Late reporting Thursdays. Well, I tell you what, we'll go back and look at current term. Here's where I've been the manual premium. Look at that. This is what I was talking about. Look at how nice that lifts.
And I still don't understand how that could possibly model that
skewing. All right. Well, let's look at this. So I got these two variables that I mentioned earlier that I found were highly correlated with each other, right? And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to see if that relationship was consistent across time. So here we have a scatter plot of that relationship of those two variables across time. So you have graphs for various years in the data. So what I did when I saw this, seeing that it was consistent, I thought that what I'd like to do is instead of keeping them together within the model and avoid issues of multicollinearity, I decided to use some principal components analysis to try and pick the pieces of these variables that explain the greatest proportion of the variance. So what I did was I transformed these models into a matrix into an orthogonal coordinate system defined by the eigenvectors. And then I ordered these eigenvectors in order of descending eigenvalues, and I created out of this I created an ordinal orthogonal basis with the first eigenvector having the highest variance in the data.
No,
bear with me. As a result, what I have here is a factor that forms an overall measure of the lossiness, which basically captures the density you see here along the main diagonals, the 45-degree line.
It sounds very complicated and intelligent. So this factor, how do I have to calculate this thing?
I thought the IT group would do that.
Okay, and it requires 3 years worth of loss ratio data and 3 years of what you're bringing?
I could work with the data team and make this happen, but I guess we should discuss that offline. And as you see here is the multivariate result for that factor one. I'm calling it factor one.
Okay, so obviously you calculated your premium somehow using exposure, right? Yeah, and loss ratio using premium. How did you deal with, are you a modified premium? Are you a manual premium? Did you take exposure, spend some class codes?
We used the premiums after schedule rating.
After schedule, okay.
I tell you what, let's just move on. I think we're going to have to talk about this. And here's that last factor that I told you about, the natural log of class code divided by some...
That's idiotic. We can't even use that. It's the natural log of class code. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense.
Okay. All right. So this is an extreme example of how things can go very, very bad, especially if you've got a predictive modeler who has no domain expertise. But even with domain expertise, there are a lot of pitfalls that are present. Now, after Joe Underwriter and Joe Predictive Modeler get together, obviously a lot of things go wrong, so the modeler goes back to the drawing board and makes a bunch of changes based on this discussion. Okay? One of the biggest ones is that the fact that he didn't want me to model pure premium, and he had some good business reasons for that. I went back to loss ratio. As a result, I got a model that just wasn't doing a good job of capturing the signal inside my data set. Here we have a lift curve, but you can see that it's really jagged. It doesn't really mesh well. So I still have problems.
Lots of them.
Yeah. So.
We have risk factors in here that are absolutely non-usable. We have minimum premiums that haven't been dealt with. We have exposures. Let's say I write a bunch of no employee minimum premium policies. How are they dealt with in law? I have absolutely no idea right now. It looks to me like whatever result I'm going to get, I'm not really going to be able to use at the time of actually underwriting the risk. What am I going to be able to generate? And from pure premium, the conversion, that kind of scoring the loss ratio, clearly looks like he has some problems. I also don't know what timing of the data he's using. I don't know whether he's used stuff that is after the time that I'm actually going to be making a risk judgment. Did he use estimated final? Did he use post-audit? I have absolutely no idea. Is it going to marry up with what I'm going to have to do in production? Right now, he has no idea. I have no idea. We're completely off the map on separate perspectives here. So after several months, the hope is, right, really what we're going to be talking about today, is getting the underwriting department, the actuary department, together on the same page, really marrying those intuitions and the understandings of the underwriter going through the workflow, understanding the transaction, where the underwriter's eyeballs are, so that the predictive modeler can really understand what needs to happen with the data, what constraints we need to put on, and really get into the head of the underwriter to give the underwriter and the business executive what they need in order to make risk judgment. So the hope is after several months, the underwriting department, the actuarial department get on the same page. Typically, it shouldn't take this long. Had the predictive modeler come to me and the underwriting department in the beginning and start to ask some of these critical questions, we may have had a model that actually made sense.
And also, continue the conversation as we go through the modeling exercise. So in this case, everything is good because I went back, I worked with the underwriter, and we came up with a model that was based on loss ratio, and now we have something very similar to the first lift curve I showed you. In addition to that, there are lots of diagnostics, although this that we can look at. Here's a residual plot to see how well our model fit. Okay. Now, this is not a technical presentation, so we're not going to get into the statistics or the mathematics very much. There are many presentations available during this seminar for you to get more into that. So at this point, our little vignette is over. I hope you've started to digest your lunch and you're ready for a little bit more serious tone to this presentation. So to set the stage, I think you've already set the stage. So we're going to be talking about, we're bringing different skill sets to the table. And some of this, the underwriter talks of traditionally underwriters have used gut feel, but they also use their own analytics. So we're looking at things, we're going to be comparing intuition versus empiricism. We're going to be looking at the idea of art versus math. How do you bring that together to the table? The underwriting perspective versus the predictive modeling perspective. In the end, what we really want is a collaborative effort. Do you want to add anything to that?
At the outset, really, as an underwriter, when I look at the actuarial department, and especially when I look at something that most underwriters really can't get their head around, can't understand like predictive modeling, I immediately am suspect of everything that's going on. I immediately think they're probably going to do something wrong. They're giving me false precision. I have intuitions, and bottom line is, I use those intuitions to make risk judgments, and I've done pretty well so far. These are some of the gaps that you have to really bridge. You've got to build bridges to allow me to understand how predictive modeling can actually hone and sharpen my intuition about what makes a good risk or a bad risk.
Okay. So we bring different perspectives to the table in an exercise like this. The predictive modeler, perhaps the actuary or our team of both, look at this as a quantitative exercise. Right? But we really do need to be talking to the underwriter. And over the course of time, I would hope that the actuary predictive analyst starts to develop a sense for what it is that the underwriter is looking for and what they think about when they're looking at their data. So we're going to go over all these perspectives over the following slides. But as the actuary, some of the things that I'm going to be considering are what method should I be using to build these models? What kind of data do I have? What's good in the data? What's bad in the data? What should I really be including? What should I be considering? Do I really want to include term sequence? Apparently not. What are the assumptions that underlie the model approach that I've decided on using? What's the overall structure that I'm looking for in my model? I'm going to be reviewing tons and tons of analytic output. I have to make sure that I'm looking at that in the right way. As I build my model, I'm going to have to make refinements. Apparently, I had to make quite a few refinements on the last one. Probably, it'll be a lot more subtle if we're doing this right. I'm concerned with mathematical accuracy or statistical accuracy because what do we as actuaries do when we study those exams? We're trying to figure out what's that one point that's going to get me to pass the exam? Well, in the end, in the real world, it's really not a point estimate that's as valuable as is of greatest importance is that we've built something that does a good job of predicting and that we know we can get a sense of how well that prediction is. And finally, there are implementation issues that I should bear in mind. From the beginning of this exercise, I really have to know if I'm modeling a specific variable, is it going to be available when we quote the policy, when we quote the price for the renewal? If it's not going to be available, that's an implementation issue. It's many issues, but that does fall into implementation. We can't build a model that the IT department cannot put into place and start using it to price our policies or to make underwriting decisions.
As another, obviously, in the new year, you saw the actuarial department as of yet hasn't really come to talk to me, which for an underwriter really kind of gets into your crawl, right? They're not coming to you. They're using the data. They don't understand how the transactions have actually occurred. And they didn't even ask what it is that we're going to need. Obviously, the first thing that we need to talk about, really try to understand, is what target should we really be modeling? What do I need as an underwriter able to use to make a risk judgment or selection. Workflow. I think one of the most critical things as an underwriter is, okay, we're going to have a predictive model, and it's going to give me, let's say it's going to give me a value, it's going to give me a result, it's going to give me an output. But where the heck is it going to go in my normal process, in my workflow? When am I going to draft this thing? At what point? What data is going to be available at that point? All of these considerations are very fundamental to getting the model right. Because if we don't know what the workflow looks like and when we're actually going to be pushing the button to go get that predictive model score, it could be prior to my getting the right information, it could be after my getting the wrong information, all sorts of different things can happen to really degrade the model performance. I'm going to have to make some assumptions about data and risk. The predictive modeler and the underwriter should be doing this together because there are things that the predictive modeler cannot possibly know in the data. Simple things that do not exist in the data, but are inherent in the data. Things like payroll capping, things like, well, the underwriter's changed this particular field to mean something else. Actuarial or the predictive modeler doesn't know that. Scoring position. Our predictive modeler are baked in schedule rating. Well, what am I going to do with that? That's got to come out because that's the only mechanism that I have to actually be able to move price. And now we've got it baked into our actual model results, which is going to increase variance and inaccuracy.
It also represents somebody else's decision, so we don't know how well that decision was made in the past.
Absolutely. It also bakes in different market cycles. So there could be dramatic scheduled credits in one year, there could be scheduled debits in the other year. Now you've got stationarity problems year to year that will probably decrease the predictive power on future out-of-sample years. So we also have to look at outputs and interpretations of those outputs. Okay? The predictive modeler and the underwriter should be getting together and saying, you know, at the end of the day, what do the underwriters really want to see? Is it a value? Is it an expected loss? Is it a loss ratio? Is it a risk grade, A to F? Is it a score from 1 to 100? What's going to make sense to the underwriters and what's going to be easy to train the future underwriters coming in to understand the output values and be able to use them in powerful and useful ways? Constraints. The predictive modeler and underwriter need to get together and really understand if there are constraints on the data. Are there certain class codes in the data set that were heretofore no longer approved or excluded? Were there per capita class codes like domestic workers? Are there particular premium sizes that were written in the past and are now not written? All of these things are going to change the sample data from what's going to be going on going forward. Model stability and ease of business. He's got a principal factor in there, which A, I don't understand, so I don't trust, but B, he uses 3 years worth of loss ratio data, 3 years worth of pure premium data. If I'm underwriting a $3,500 account, I will not be able to get that information from agents, period. So we've got to make some sort of a change there. We've got to go back to the drawing board on that particular respect. All of these considerations should happen prior to data exploration. They should happen with the underwriting department, all the underwriting stakeholders, and with the predictive model and actual department as well. There are other market considerations. What is my loss ratio goal? If my loss ratio goal significantly departs from the average loss ratio in my sample, how am I going to scale that to the right loss ratio goal? Things like that, underwriting really needs to understand. And then finally, implementation. How do I implement this thing? Really kind of includes everything above. So this is more of an agenda. We're going to touch on each one of these briefly as we go forward.
Sure. Okay, so method. The predictive modelers, one of my perspectives, is what method am I going to use to solve this business problem? You know, there's a whole slew of different predictive modeling techniques that I can use. And if I can't explain that to Matt over here, then what... Do you think he's really going to buy into the model that I finally bring to him? So, for example, if I'm developing a generalized linear model, right, and can I explain that to him in some kind of layman's terms? I need to understand the theory behind it, because if I don't understand the theory, one second, please. If I don't understand the theory, I'm probably going to do some things wrong as I'm developing the model. But I need to be able to explain to him what the how to understand what I'm about to do for him. So, you know, I also have here the closed form relevant equations for a GLM. If anybody wants to know what this is, come see me afterwards. But what is a GLM, right? It's a predictive modeling technique that looks at a historical data set that includes a variable of interest, oftentimes termed the dependent variable, or the target variable. It's got lots of different names. And there's data on lots and lots of other potential variables that I'm going to use to predict the value of that target variable. That's a very simple thing. Now, if I was having a conversation with him and he didn't understand that, I'd want to get into a little bit more depth with you.
So let's say I'm 10 underwriters in a room and this formula comes up on the screen. I immediately don't understand it. And I immediately distrust anything this guy's going to do for me, right? I have to understand what the heck you're doing for me, right? How is this going to improve my intuitions? How is this going to make me a better underwriter? Why is this going to work? There's a couple of different variations of this, but one of the best that I've heard is, look, when you underwrite all of your risks, you've got a whole bunch of risks that don't have any losses. You've got a few that have losses. There's a distribution of those. What we have to do is we got to do something like this, and we really have to account for the zero-point mass, all of those risks that you underwrite that don't have any losses. And so a good way to do that, there are several statistical methods, but you've got to fit the right statistical method to the actual data that you're looking at, right? I sort of get it, right? Okay, but what the heck is a generalized linear model? Right.
Well, didn't I just tell you?
Well, from an underwriting perspective, I think what it really is...
Well, what are we trying to predict, right? In this case, we're trying to predict the loss ratio, right? So the expected value of Y sub I, okay, going back to the equation because I'm an actuary, right? I like that stuff. And on the left-hand side over there, we're looking at loss ratio. We're trying to predict loss ratio. On the right-hand side, just think of the XI and the beta over there. Forget about the Greek values and just think of this as the pertinent variables that you think, as an underwriter, have perhaps an intuitive feel for what are the values of those variables and how do those values help you predict the expected future losses for that risk.
Ah, so let's say I for your loss ratio is predicted. That's what I use to make my risk judgments. We can put that in that side.
That's correct.
We can see how it relates to this stuff.
Right. But the beautiful thing about this and other techniques that we use is that it's not just looking at the three-year loss ratio. It's looking at the three-year loss ratio and other variables of interest. So if you've got something else that is of interest to you, we throw them all in there, and the technique looks at how those are related to one another through something called correlation, right? Are they correlated? Do they tend to move in the same direction or in opposite directions in some kind of a systematic way, and it builds that into your prediction. So it does, and we'll get to that a little bit later, it can show you that on an intuitive basis when you get results by just looking at a table of data and you say, three-year loss ratio, look at this. You know, it tends to increase, right? It really predicts the loss. Well, I can show you that maybe it's not as big as that, or perhaps it's bigger than that when you bring other variables into the mix.
This is a critical piece, because as an underwriter now, I may be a lot more interested, because now I can take everything that I think helps me evaluate risks, and I can try and ground them out in this whole process. The predictive modeler is now my friend. The predictive modeler can now help me to understand the relationship of my own intuitions to what the expected values are, what the actual predicted values are.
Mm-hmm. So, moving on.
So, as an underwriter, the first thing I have to figure out is what should my target be? Okay, if you're doing rating plans, pure premium frequency versus severity, much more interesting to look at from a risk selection standpoint at the time of actually making a judgment about those risks really is something like loss probability or loss ratio. So at the very beginning, when I'm going through this exercise with the predictive modeler, I really have to sit down and I have to think about, with all of my underwriters, what is it that we really want to know? Okay? Do we want to know pure premium? Do we want to know frequency severity? There's lots of trade-offs between the target that you're making here, but that should always be done in coordination with underwriting so that they buy in to what that target value is. Because if they don't buy in, it's going to be extremely difficult to implement your model, and you're going to go through multiple iterations before you do
that. Right, and as you're having that conversation with your underwriting team, you should also be having that conversation with my team, because we're the ones who are going to be building this, and we have to understand this. And I think that we would have a lot of input into helping you decide. In the extreme case that we saw earlier, I apparently just did what I felt was right without talking to you. We have a question.
Can you take a minute to comment on extension
exposure versus non-level exposure? I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Extension exposure versus non-level exposure for developing tenants. Okay, the question is, can you comment on using extension of exposures versus non-level exposures? Well, that does depend on how who is not available in this case. The more data you have, you can actually rewrite every single policy, correct? If you're going to use a parallelogram, that you're probably going to get a half because you don't have as much information available. In context of loss of health, can you mention loss of health in terms of dealing with development? So, I'm not quite sure I understand the question in the context, but let me answer it this way. We are dealing with a long tail on the business term, and we are doing inspection of the district for the national government. So, we definitely have to make a smart answer to this, but that's how we turn our data on. Which method we use, the parallelogram, the extension of exposures, the extension of exposures, and loss of confidence is critical. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Just as an aside, we're not necessarily using the microphone, so if you can't hear us, please let us know.
Okay.
So we get back to workflow. Okay, where is this scoring engine going to live? Where is this actual predictive model going to give us results back? At what point during the normal workflow is the model going to be used? When will the output values be rendered to make a risk judgment? All of these are extremely important because if you end up using future information, you're going to end up getting your predictions wrong. Okay? A perfect example of that would be using in the data for your independent variables a post-audit value that is absolutely not going to be available at time of production. So very important to sit down with the predictive modeler and the underwriter across the table and say, okay, let's really get down and look at what the workflow looks like. What do the screens look like the underwriter has to go through? And more importantly, gotta sit down with the underwriter and find out where their eyeballs go. Because a lot of times you just take screenshots, you think you got it all nailed, you go ahead and build your model. Turns out that the underwriter doesn't use half the screens. They use some of the fields in totally different ways. They may input a loss value that includes ALAE, and you build it excluding ALAE, for example. So there are different things you have to do with the underwriter so that you can identify all the quirks and constraints you're going to have to make your family. What are the underwriters going to be doing before and after they render the outputs? So, for instance, is an underwriter going to get a score, put the values in, and then get an additional loss run that changes the prediction fundamentally? So you really have to be careful about what is available to the underwriter at that time of scoring, and you've got to make sure that the underwriter knows that that score is going to be invalidated if additional information comes into play. And how does the workflow constrain the data? I think we talked about that a little bit. You just got to make sure that you've got your scoring parameters down, and that you know those parameters in so that the underwriter understands when the score is valid and when the score is invalid because the data is.
Okay. This is probably not giving you too much information that you don't already know as actuaries, but data is really important to the predictive model. You've got to make sure you have the right data. What data do you have? What data do you need? What historical information are you going to be using? You know, how much do you have? What exposure base are you using? Is there enough exposure? What's your frequency? What are your claim counts? What states are put in the model? Do you want a three state in the model? Are you doing a single state model? Are you doing a multi-state model? Is there a difference between how your
you're writing your policies within the different states. If so, how are you going to deal with that? The explanatory variables, right? We talked about that before. What variables are you going to use? What is the list of variables you're going to use to try and come up with the most predictive variables to perhaps help the underwriter make his or her decisions in the end? So this is a real big opportunity for you to work with the underwriting team to not only build rapport, but to find out what is going on in their heads, what is their gut feel, what kinds of analyses are they looking at, what variables are they looking at, and see if you can't incorporate that in your own analysis.
This will absolutely win underwriters over your way of thinking. If you can actually sit down with them and say, what do you think makes a good risk and a bad risk? Give me everything you think about. Well, I think about a two-year loss ratio, a three-year loss ratio. Sometimes I put more credence on a three-year loss ratio than a two-year loss ratio. I really kind of like to throw out the most current term loss ratio because I've heard that's what NCCI does with their experience modification. I look at hazard groups sometimes. I really don't like construction or over-the-road exposure, so I usually really pay attention to those particular class codes. Okay. Things like that, the predictive model can take and then go back to the data and start to shape those intuitions and show univariately and multivariately what those intuitions really do, how they really interact with the loss ratio, with whatever dependent variable is. It's going to allow those underwriters to really hone some of those intuitions, discard what really doesn't work at the end of the day, and will probably allow them to really get creative about other curiosities that maybe they don't always use, but they kind of thought about and want to take a look at it. This becomes a real sort of exploratory discovery period for the underwriters. Really gets them into liking the whole predictive modeling process. You want to get them involved as early as possible, and you want to get those intuitions grounded out in visual ways, in graphs, so they can really see what their intuitions are doing in the data that you get.
Right, and part of that process is looking at your variables and thinking about perhaps some adjustments you might need to your data, or perhaps transformations. Of course, there's a pitfall there. I gave you a great example earlier where I transformed the class code using some kind of mathematical formula that made absolutely no sense. You never use that in production. But sometimes transformations are very valuable as we go through our exploratory data analysis. We look at what the distribution of some of the explanatory variables themselves to see, what shape those distributions take. How skewed are they? That can give me an idea of what types of transformations I might want to make. Specifically, in that case, to continuous variables, I might want to do some dimension reductions techniques or clustering analysis to see which variables are basically giving you the same information in order to find the one or a subset of those that are most relevant to the analysis you're about to do. Be careful. I would recommend that we always be careful of going on a fishing expedition. If you haven't heard that term, it basically means that you know what you want, so you go out there and you make it happen. Well, I did that earlier with my transformation of the class code. I wanted that to be very predictive, and I made it so. In the end, it really wasn't. So don't go on a fishing expedition. Finally, the modeler has to put together a plan of how he's going to work with that data, how he's going to he or she is going to split that data into train, test, and perhaps a holdout validation data set that's out of sample, something that you do not touch at all during the entire course of your analysis. Once you've built your model, you've trained your model, you've tested your model against another holdout set. Now, when you come to your underwriting team and you think you've found what you want to test that against some data that has never been touched throughout the entire course of your analysis. Structuring that at the very beginning is highly important. Assumptions. So we both have assumptions that we bring to the table, right? The modeler's assumptions, if I'm building a GLM, I'm using GLMs because it's perhaps a little easier to explain, and I think everybody here has been exposed to it by this point in time. So if I'm building a GLM model, I have to make some distributional assumptions. If I'm modeling frequency, for example, the general distributional assumption that we use in the GLM is to use a Poisson, although you could use a negative binomial if your data is highly skewed towards zero, for example. For severity, you might want to pick a gamma distribution. You might want to combine frequency and severity models. If you're building a loss cost, you might want to build a assume that you're using a Tweedy distribution. And if you're building a probability of loss type model, well, the binomial distribution is probably your best choice. In addition to that, we also have the ability to, in a sense, transform your data via the link function. So in typical class plan types analyses, all of your factors in the end are going to be multiplicative. Now, we're not doing that here, but I'm just bringing that up because in the more traditional personal lines applications, the link function you select is multiplicative. However, you do have the option of selecting an additive, or I'm sorry, the identity link function, which provides you with an additive set of parameter estimates, and then for the binomial distribution, you generally use the logit link function.
On the underwriting side, there are some assumptions that I've got to come to the table with when I'm talking to the predictive model. Number one, I have to understand my data enough to know what my average loss ratio is historically and what I want it to be. Okay? Because some conversion has to happen so that I can sync the modeling results to what my loss ratio goal is going to be going forward. Do I have a market penetration goal? Does it shift in certain ways? Does that fit with the data? Am I going to have to constrain the data in a certain way, knowing that I want to grow a certain premium size of business, right, for example? Do I want to go into certain states and less into other states? All of those things are very important to come in with so that the predictive modeler can look at the data and underwriting the predictive modeler can work together in order to shape the data in such a way that it fits what you want to do going forward. Syncing market forces with model tier cuts. Obviously, when you have a big framework, a lot of times you take a look at equal premium, equal exposure, equal policy count, things like that. But what you really want to do from an underwriting side is to come into this discussion with, hey, look, this is what we'd like to do. We've got about 60% of our business actually has a 10% average scheduled credit. We've got 20% that has an average 10% debit. And you also want to take model results at the end of the day, and you want to apply what those scheduled credits are today to identify if you've got any swing limits. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But these are assumptions that you've got to have when you're coming in to talk to the predictive model. Independent variables. When you sit down with the predictive model and you've got all of this data in front of you, you really have to go through and say, look, what independent variables can we really use? What are we going to be able to get from the agent? What passes the piece of business test so that agents will actually give you this information? You won't get negatively selected against because you're just too darn hard to do business with.
Is it? Okay. So one of the things that, you know, as a modeler, we have to think about the structure. And actually, in the end, we're all thinking about this because we're working as a team, but model structure, you need to really clearly define the structure of your model, not only for yourself, but also for your data team and for the underwriters so they understand what's going on. So we can throw an equation up there. We can say that our expected loss ratio, yeah. So I've got this G inverse N. Forget the G. That just means that my model is fitting an intercept, the alpha over there, plus these other factors that my final model is including things like the frequency of a two-term average, the EMOD amount, and a bunch of other stuff. But perhaps even more useful in dealing with the underwriter is providing him the information on all the factors that you are considering, perhaps, as a first step, and in the end, re-providing this to show him what you've selected, and showing him perhaps not so quantitative but more qualitative descriptions of those variables. So here I have a list of variables, and then I have some columns that say, is this an intuitive variable or not? And you're probably going to work with your underwriter to define this stuff. If it's not intuitive, you may have a problem, right? We have one there where we're not sure if it is or isn't. Is it going to be available at production? If it's not, you're going to throw that one out. We should do that in the beginning. Don't waste the time. Do we have support on the IT side to get that data? If not, how much money is it going to take to build that in if we find that it's predictive? Those kinds of things. A little bit of information you need to provide. The data or the structure of the variables that you have in there as a modeler, I need to know what's going on. Do I have continuous data? Is class code really continuous? Is it quasi-continuous? I'd like to take the poll, but I won't. It's not, right? It's really more a categorical type variable, but it looks continuous to me. You know, luckily for me, I have a little background in this. what kind of interactions are we going to be looking at? How do I identify what interactions we want? Is it just based on intuition? Is it based on what we've done in the past? Or is it based on some sophisticated analysis that I might want to perform? Are there any restrictions I need to impose on any of the variables? Do I want to construct some new variables or transform some? But as we go through this process early on, it's really, really important to work with the underwriting team to show them some univariate results, because this is where, more so in the past, perhaps less so as we go through into the future, is that the underwriter is going to be looking at univariate results already. So if I come up to the underwriter and say, look, you told me that this is going to, as the value increases, the loss ratio increases, but I'm seeing something completely different, that would be quite revelatory at that point in time. More than likely, that's not going to happen, but the review of those univariate graphs or tables, histograms, whatever you have, is a very important place and time for you and the underwriter to really start collaborating. It's really key at this point. Did you want to add?
Yeah, that fundamentally will allow the predictive modeler to identify the components in whatever risk factors he's got in the model currently and put those up against underwriters that really understand the data on a transactional level and may have understandings about the data that the predictive model cannot get from it. Simple things like minimum premium policies. Okay? And in work comp, if you've got a minimum premium policy and you've got, let's say you've got a loss ratio target and you're using manual premium, okay? You could have a $5 manual premium, but you get $750 for that account. So you've got to have that discussion with underwriting as to how you want to deal with that. Do you want to go ahead and floor the minimum premium? If so, maybe you have zero exposure, you have no employment premium policies, you've got an owner only sole proprietor that excludes himself, and so you've got basically $750 free money from financial sources. What are you going to do with those particular accounts? And how do you, if you've got a lot of them, how do you adjust those so that they don't skew the model in some way? So a lot of times you've got to have some sort of implied exposure based on that minimum premium. So if you are going to be looking at your premium, you've got some sort of a rational exposure based on that.
I just like to add that this, to me, is very can lead to some incredibly interesting conversations with your business partners, your clients, what have you. This process can take a long time, especially in the beginning when you're showing results to somebody who may not have looked at it in the same way that you're presenting it to them. So you need to take a little bit of time to explain either the tables or the graphics that you're showing them. It's really a univariate analysis, but still, this leads to great conversations and oftentimes leads to the discovery of new variables or new transformations. Well, and he was just bringing some of those points up, so I find this a very great experience from the predictive analytics side. Okay, so I mentioned earlier that the analyst is going to create all kinds of model output. This is a pretty traditional, at this point, I guess we could use the term traditional, right? GLM output. Is there anybody here who doesn't know how to read this graph if this is a GLM expected result? Okay, the only thing I'll say is that the green line at the top is the result of a univariate analysis, and the other one is your point estimates for your parameter. For premium size groups, grouped into 13 buckets right here, with some standard error interval estimates around it. The one thing that comes out of this is that the univariate results and the multivariate results do track very well, but when you've combined other factors in the model, the lift that you're seeing is a little bit lower.
This is a great opportunity when you're actually graphing out some of the underwriter intuitions that you've built as risk factors. Okay, you can really help the underwriter understand that when they're making these univariate decisions on a multivariate basis, they may have increased lift, they may have decreased lift. But a lot of very important and key decisions can be made going through this process. Because a lot of times, you can find, and underwriters have found that a lot of the rules that they have in place don't make any sense. That they don't make sense, and they're requiring additional information. Why do you even have this residual? So this is a great opportunity for the predictive modeler to help underwriting recast their business rules and make them more rational based on what they can find and what they're doing.
Yeah, and when there is, a quick side note, when there is a discrepancy between intuition results. It's also an opportunity to try and find out, on my point, try to explain to you why we're seeing something different from the invariant results. So some of the things that we'll look at is what variables are correlated with this variable, because if you have something else in the model that's highly correlated or markedly correlated, I guess, to some degree, I can find those variables, pull them out, and show him what the results look like when you've taken them out. That would kind of help explain to the underwriter what's really going on here. There's an interrelationship between two factors or three factors, and when you include all three of them, and all three of them are highly predictive, you get results that, while counterintuitive at first, by this point in time, we might actually be coming to an agreement on, oh, that makes sense because.
A great example of that might be the frequency one term back as opposed to the current term. One of the reasons, obviously, late reporting, but also reserving practices, right? So you have to stop and you've got to take a look at the current term when it's gone. Lots of other stuff happens. If you look frequency one term back, much more seasoned stuff, you're including IBNR, may have a much more direct correlation to the dependent variable. So that's a perfect one to dialogue with underwriting, because you can actually get to a point where both sides say, oh, I get it. Okay, that makes sense. And then you can really start to work together through
lines. Okay, I'm going to just show one other graph like this, but before I do, I just want to make a caveat. Please, don't go back to your firms and make decisions based off of these graphs. These are purely fictional, okay? Didn't want to give anything away. So here we have an interaction between the employee count and a state variable where I've taken California and separated it out and I've bucketed all the NCCI states together. Okay. So, and the x-axis is your employee count. The figures have been disguised, and again, don't make any decisions on this. Prove it out in your own data first, right? But as you look off to the far left, you see that in California, when the employee count is much lower, the loss ratio experience tends to be much higher than it is in the NCCI states. Not sure why that is, but that this everywhere else, especially in the middle, everything looks pretty much the same. There's some dispersion off to the far right, but there's also not as much data here and not as much data on the far left. So this is just an example. Again, don't make decisions based on that. Please.
Graphs like that, though, and looking at interactions between things really make underwriters draw them out they love. So really, to be able to grab some of those, to talk with underwriting and try and identify some interactions that they think are important and to graph them out will make many friends. Okay, talking about the scoring position a little bit. In our vignette, the predictive modeler took post-scheduled credit from the earned annual premium or the direct written premium at the end of the
I can't remember. Let me go back to my notes. Okay.
One of the things that you really have to do is you got to sit down with underwriting and say, okay, where exactly do you want to score this? Because I've got to create a target that may be different based on where you want to score this thing. And grounding that out and really understanding when they're going to be able to get that score is extremely important. You want to do it before or after EMOC. Obviously, you typically want to do it before schedule rating. But do you want to bake in your LCM or not? There are decisions to be made with underwriting involved at each one of these places so that you get the right scoring so that you can include the right data. The other one is outputs. Okay. Depending on what target you use, the real big question that you need to have underwriting answer is what value do you want? Okay? What's going to help the underwriter? You can build a great model and you can just throw out a loss ratio, but is that what they really need? Because a lot of times a loss ratio figure can be interpreted in a different way by different underwriters. So do you want a loss ratio? Do you want an expected loss value? Do you want some sort of a risk rate, A through F? Depending on what the business rules are, how they will apply those business rules, you're going to end up with different outputs. You're going to end up with different results, and you're going to have to transform some of those results so that they make sense. Having that conversation with underwriting earlier rather than later is extremely important.
Okay, refinements. Now, I guess I'll start talking about this. I'm sure Matt will have something to say about it. But refinements is a modeler's thing, right? But it comes from having discussions with your business partners, your clients.
what kinds of things can lead to you making refinements to your model? Well, you know, if you throw something in your model that's just the regulators aren't going to like, maybe I threw that there in the beginning because I really did want to let the data speak for itself. You might need to make some changes because of that. I'm not quite sure why the data is there, but are the variables acceptable? You know, would they be acceptable to the underwriters? If the underwriters don't like what you've included, you might need to either transform them into something that's more acceptable or take them out altogether. You need stuff that's explainable. If you're building an underwriting decision model, the underwriter's going to want to understand and be able to explain it, or they're not going to buy in on this, right? You might want to make some changes based on business knowledge, things that Matt has brought to the table with me as we're building our model. And sometimes you make changes because perhaps the philosophy of your company is such that this is something that even though maybe your competitors are doing, you yourself do not want to do. And finally, and this list could go on and on, some of the changes are just simply because the data is not available. And I've been in modeling exercises where after a considerable amount of effort and a lot of discussion with the IT department, the underwriters, product managers, senior management, in the end, for some reason or another, something falls through the cracks and you get pretty close to the end and you've got a variable in there that's just not going to be available in production. I wish I could say that's never happened to me before, but it has happened. It causes a lot of frantic actuaries or analysts running around, but you really want to, again, the point is communication. Start early and talk often and repeat yourself.
If you have a risk factor like hail size in your model, even though it's really predictive, A, the underwriter's not going to believe it, and B, the first time that underwriter has to explain that hail size is the reason they're declining an account for an agent, you just lost the agent. So it's extremely important to have explainable, at least semi-intuitive risk factors in your model.
Okay.
As an underwriter, we talked about a lot of these. One, I think, really important, if you're writing pool business and you bake in your pool business and you know that you're not really worried about what the loss ratio is on that business, obviously it's going to skew your model. So make sure that you're taking out things that you are not part of your normal voluntary work comp business. Domestic worker policies. Even if you have a few of them, they have a tendency to skew results. So you want to make sure you get things out that are not on a payroll basis, things like domestic workers. Schedule rating caps. You want to be mindful that if your predictive model is spitting out, hey, put a 50% credit on this thing, and you only have 15% credit available, what is that going to do to model results in that particular state with that particular rating plan? So it's very important for underwriting and the actuarial department to sit down with the rating plans and understand. Now, I think most of the people in this room, the actuaries, are going to know what the rating plans are. But sitting down with underwriting and identifying what schedule rating is available from a market consideration standpoint, very important. Discontinued classes or risk types. If you've got premium size cap that came in recently, you want to make sure that you capture all of those. If there were discontinued classes, an underwriter manager made a decision to no longer write roofing or framing, you want to make sure that you're excluding those going forward because that is a true business constraint that we should be in the data. And minimum premium policies, and we touched on that if in your data you have minimum premium policies and you're at a manual premium, just exposure times the rate, you're going to end up with some real strange premium values that you'd likely probably want to gross up to a minimum premium value. Model stability versus ease of use. We know, intuitively, underwriters know that the fear loss ratio is great. A lot of times they can't get it, especially on small policies. So you really have to marry what is the most predictive with ease of doing business for the agent, what you're actually going to be able to get. And sometimes that means taking some three-year average loss ratios out and using a service like up to three-year loss ratios. It may be a little bit less predictive, but it's something that you know is going to be available, at least more available, in production when they're going out to make risk decisions and they're getting submissions in the world. Employee count. A lot of times, some of that data is not accurate, especially if it's being put in by agents. So
Okay, and then you know, the modeler is often concerned with accuracy of model results, right? I said earlier that one of the things that we do is come up with point estimates, especially in a GLM context. I come up with a point estimate, but is that good enough? You know, use the minimum bias techniques that years ago, that's what we used, and we came up with point estimates, and that was sufficient. Probably still being used in some cases, but if we wanted to throw a little bit of accuracy around those point estimates, we could start looking at standard errors, right? Build those confidence level estimates around your point estimates. But what does that tell you? It just tells you how accurate that point estimate is for that one parameter. So you've got 10 variables in your analysis, and you've got 1,000 parameters. You've just been making numbers up, maybe 600 parameters. It depends on the actual factors that you've selected. Now, you can look and see how accurate your model is on a parameter by parameter basis. And hopefully, the vast majority of them, you'll see some pretty good standard error results. But in the end, what are we really interested in? We're really interested in this case in particular, is a policy level estimate for a policy you're just about to write. So is your model going to be really good at the policy level? What is the credibility of that prediction that you're making based on a model you've built on historical data for this policy that you're going to write 30 to 60 days, that you're writing now, and it's going to be an exposure that starts 30 to 60 days in the future? So one of the things that we do here is, instead of worrying so much about the parameter estimates, which we do worry about, what we do is we pool our risks together in this bin framework. So we're going to be pooling our risks, we're going to rank order them, and we're going to put them into bins of approximately equal exposure. And what we do now is that we substitute the... We're looking at the accuracy of the results within each bin, and we price, or we make our underwriting decisions, or we guide our underwriters to make their decisions based on the accuracy of the results on a bin-by-bin framework. Did you want to add something to this?
Yeah, it's really important to go over this in detail with your underwriters because they don't think in a bin framework at all. They think, okay, I've got this particular information, I'm really looking at a policy level prediction. And so you get a lot of back and forth when you're trying to explain the bin framework. But what we're doing is we're really trying to bin things together to get credibility out of sample size. Okay? And a lot of graphs and going through this with underwriters gets you farther along on this bin framework because you do get a lot of, well, why do I care about the bin? What I really want to know is this particular risk going to have a 50% loss ratio or a 51.2% loss ratio? Now, a lot of times underwriters can mistakenly think that you can get that type of precision at the policy level, which is just not true. So going through that and helping the underwriting department understand the bin framework and each individual underwriter understand the bin framework goes a long way to how to actually use model results.
Yeah, and Matt mentioned the graphs. Earlier we showed you some lift curves where we had data in deciles. You saw that really nice, I think it was on this, it slopes this way with the really high expected values for each bin. It's off to the left and the lower expected values are off to the right. That's a graphic that we would be using to have this discussion because now we are concerned about sample size quite often with commercial accounts, right? We don't have as much data necessarily as you do for a personal lines carrier that writes in all 50 states and has a 10% market share or what have you. So sample size is critical. Credibility is definitely critical for us, the actuaries. We want to make sure that if we're going to say, here's a point estimate, do we believe it or we don't? We take those individual predictions, look at them in the context of a bin, and now we've got credible data. And everything within that bin really represents a similar type of exposure. Okay, so we started with a little vignette, and we're not going to do another one at this point, but Matt and I tried to illustrate to you, I hope we were successful to some extent, that building, developing good predictive models, especially for the underwriters when they want to make their underwriting decisions in a workers' compensation context, in any context really, collaboration is key. We both bring a lot of skills to the table, and they're complementary skills. Sometimes there's overlap, and the more you do this, there's more overlap. But in the long run, collaboration is key. Start it early. Start it at the very beginning of the process when you're even just considering
the idea of building a model. Because what you're going to do from this is, well, you're going to learn from each other, but you're going to build a model in the end that's much more predictive and satisfies underwriter intuition. Perhaps it'll change underwriter intuition, shape the underwriter's intuition based on maybe more in-depth analysis that they've used in the end. In the beginning, I'm sorry. Anything else, Ed?
You nailed it.
Okay. So with that, are there any questions? Yes.
It's a good question, and theoretically, you could very well get away with just a model, right? There is additional information that is always brought to the table by underwriting that I don't think you're going to be able to get away from. It's being able to identify the heavy or the light-headed class. It's not going to end up in the data. Now, the nice collaboration that you can do on a going forward basis when you start to implement and use predictive analytic models in what comes is to really ground out constrain it. You have to constrain it so that you didn't have some of those more complicated risks in there with date tables and exceptions.
I guess I'd like to just add that getting underwriters buy-in from the beginning is a very critical point, but also thinking about the implementation of the model in the end is also critical. So how is the underwriter actually going to use this? Are they going to use this model to look at every single risk and make a decision yes or no to follow the model? Are you going to build in some incentives for them to follow the model a certain percentage of the time? And if they don't, they have to have a really good reason. You know, all this stuff goes down to implementation in the end. And there has to be some way that I think what you want to do is you want to improve the life of the underwriter. Take them away from those silly little accounts where they don't really need to look at them. Let them focus on the more interesting ones, where there is more data available that they have probably never captured. But and I think we do need to make that point for our discussions, that we're not only working together, but we're trying to make their life a little bit more easy, or give them time to focus on the more interesting stuff. And there has to be some type of incentive built into the use of this model. Otherwise, the model will probably just sit on the shelf, and it'll be something that they see on their screen, that they look away from it and make a decision.
That arguably becomes more of a management decision, not an underwriter's.
That's true.
Right. The underwriter, well, you are no longer involved in this small stuff. You just get involved in the big stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or a comment, a question.
Sure.
One thing to keep in mind, but as you know, the representative said, they don't have a point to think the underwriter has to raise it. We have to acknowledge that every piece of data in our modeling data set has been underwritten. It has already been through the underwriting process, it's already been through the risk management process, if there are missing exposures, they've been picked up through the underwriting process. So we don't really know what will happen.
That's true.
Very
well.
Very
well.
The human factor.
That's exactly
there's
right.
An unknown
yeah.
world out there that's not enough modeling. The only way we can ever find out that modeling could replace underwriting in those types of analysis to stop underwriting.
Yes. And that's where. If you have perfect data, which you never will, because your data, you will never have loss ratio target data for submitted accounts that were either subsequently quoted and not bound or stuff that was claimed, right? So you've already got that sort of inherent bias there that is really going to require an underwriter's art, so to speak, in making judgments like that.
That almost gets back to the comment from the keynote speaker. Believe me, the comment that you should actually test and actually write some stuff randomly that you wouldn't normally write to learn and improve the model. Because I kind of see that you launch the model, you evaluate the results, you may write some stuff you hadn't written before that an underwriter might not believe is a good risk. You still write it, you learn from it, and you improve the model. So the model, I don't believe you're making the point that the model just gets launched and then it just stays as it is and never changes the model. I would argue it should be fluid. It's going to learn. More business you put on the books, and arguably probably less business that the underwriter normally wouldn't write if it puts on the books. The model learns from it, tweaks the formulas, the equations, and improves over time.
Yeah, and I mean, really, when model monitoring and refreshing of data, and even, I mean, a great example would be somebody who writes pool business as well, because then you can grab interesting samples and you can throw out against the model and see what happens. If we were to write this class report, if we were to write that, right? And then you can become more informed about that. But I think monitoring your model and looking at results and refreshing it with newer data is pretty important.
Now, I'm not so sure that we're any insurers would like to write the risks that they would never write, but just to see how it impacts this is built into their underwriting models. I know that in the UK they do stuff like that for personal lines, that quote. Randomly just say, oh, you're don't know